Good. I'd like to ask for your attention for some clarifications, something to the context of our exercise. I'd like to address a topic of which I suspect that you have gained experience in the last few days. The topic is that of the hindrances. It is a very likely occurrence that when we try to put effort, when we try to refine the mind and practice awareness exercises in a sustained and in an orchestrated way, it is very likely that we meet with resistance. In Buddhist psychology, this resistance has been encapsulated by a teaching on the five hindrances. There is a little anecdote going with this. The anecdote speaks of a Brahman, somebody who was well positioned. His name was Sangarava. I don't object if you forget that name again. He was a wealthy man, already quite progressed in age, and he approached the Buddha and said, how comes there are days when I cannot remember the things I have learned by heart? I have learned many mantras, you know. A Brahman was in need of learning the Vedic teachings by heart, so he learned the verses of the Vedas, and that is quite a substantial volume of text, so you need to rehearse this, you know. And if you don't rehearse it, you tend to forget it, like all things, you know. So Brahmins of his standing would try to maintain their learning by repeating, by rehearsing to themselves what they had learned by heart. And he comes also to the Buddha and asks him, well, I don't understand. There are days when I can't remember the things I have well rehearsed, I have well practiced. They seem inaccessible to me. Let alone the things I haven't really well practiced and well rehearsed, those things I have no chance of remembering. And yet there are other days when I can remember the things I have not well rehearsed. Even those things I can easily remember, yeah? Let alone the things I have well rehearsed. So how come? What does make the difference? How does my memory at some point work very well and at other moments work very deplorably? So the Buddha explains to this Brahman the five hindrances. Five hindrances of mind that are also the hindrances that stop the mind from going quiet, that stop the mind from being able to continually stay with something, and that stop the mind from becoming very quiet, from going calm, from attaining samadhi, in other words. So what the Buddha gives him is an analogy. He says, imagine, Sangarava, there is a man who likes to go and find out, recognize his own face. Yeah. He looks for a reflection of his own face. And he takes different vessels of water to find in the water the reflection of his own face so that he can recognize himself. This is a beautiful image of somebody seeking self-understanding. Yeah. The image of seeking the reflection of one's own face in the water. Across cultures you have this image, somebody tries to find out what is true about himself by looking at the reflection of his face. So this Brahman seeks the recognition of his own face and looks for that reflection in water. And so the Buddha continues, the first of these vessels, the Brahman looks for the reflection of his own face, is a vessel of water that is troubled in color. The water is brown, it is red, it is It is coloured by many different colours, but mostly it is coloured by the colour of red. Yeah. So the virtue that is troubled and serves as an improper medium for the reflection of the Brahman's face is an analogy for what is called kama in Pali Buddhism. That means sense desire, not to be confused with kamma, yeah. Although the two have a connection, it's very clearly necessary that we distinguish. Kamma means sensuality. It means both the capacity to enjoy sensuality. It means sense object, so that which serves as the basis for enjoyment in our senses. And it means sense desire, yeah? So that which we seek to fulfill and gain gratification for. So kamma is everything to do with our sensory capacity for enjoyment. So kamma is a big obstacle, not just for Brahmins in their reciting their mantras, but also for meditators. One thing that stirs up the mind and stops it from becoming quiet is preoccupation with pleasurable things. Now, what are objects of kamma? Kamma are all things that I can enjoy. All things that you can hear, smell, taste, touch, and you, what do we have? Hear, see, smell, taste, touch, all things that you can think of, memorize, fantasize, yeah? So kamma are not just the five outer senses, smell, taste, touch, and what was it? Yeah, habit. There's nothing missing. It's not just those five, but it's also the objects of mind, yeah? So memories of pleasurable things or fantasies of pleasurable things, images of pleasurable nature, all this can serve as the basis for sense desire, yeah? So if you longingly reminisce about your last holiday, then this is kamma, yeah? If you think of your soft bed at home, this is kamma. If you think of your soft companion at home in the bed, this is kamma, yeah? All this is kamma. If you would like to do a walk alone in the forest and recite a poem of Rilke, this is also kamma, yeah? There's different degrees of kamma, all the things you can long for, all the things you find pleasurable and can attach to and wish for and hanker after, all these things are kamma. So kamma obviously is a big obstacle in meditation. Yeah. Some of us sit here and think about all the things they're going to do after this horrible retreat finally comes to an end. Yeah. What they're going to eat, how they're going to move, where they will be going, what are the things they're going to talk about. Yeah. So this can fill quite a few hours of the day, you know. You can really refine this. Yeah. In fact, you can spend a monk's life like that. You can sit in a little hut and dream of all the places you would like to go to if you weren't a monk. So, the next of the obstacles, let us start with the analogy. The Buddha says, listen, Sangharava, if you look for your face in the reflection of water and you get a kettle of water that is boiling, the water is bubbling, you will not be able to recognize your face in there. You will not be able to recognize the nature of reality, the nature of your well-being, the nature of other people's well-being, and the nature of both, yours and the others. Why? Because the bubbles in the water are making it impossible to recognize your face. What are these bubbles? The bubbles are anger and hatred. So the second big obstacle for our meditation exercises, everything connected with anger, hatred, aversion, rejection. Yeah? In Buddhism, this is called dosa, yeah? Or in the more specific form of an obstacle in meditation, It's called vyapada. The first one, kama. The second one, vyapada. This is another big region in which we can waste a lot of time. We can sit here hating, yeah, hating ourselves, hating the teacher, hating the clock, hating the food, hating the neighbors, hating our life. Or we can be very specific, you know, I'm gonna hate this little brown one there in the back row, you know, who always has her feet out when I try to walk by, or who has stolen my cushion, or who has this loud breathing, or, you know, or who always squeezes in the food chain, you know. Are you really gonna hate her for that? If you live with people together and you live so close, you know, and you start to observe, you know, things which look pretty harmless on the first day, after the 3 days you realize there is system to this. Yeah, she always does this. And then, and the next step is you wait for her to do it again. Yeah? Yeah? You feel it's gonna come, and then really, and lo and behold, she does it yet again. Yeah? And you really want to punish her. You really want to punish her. So this is hating. Now it's easy to hate. It's very easy. We're good at it. I think probably better than any other culture. You know? The Western mind is fantastic at hating. It's one of the shocking things for Asian teachers to recognize how willing Western people are at self-hatred. We're a lot better than most Asian people at that. And that makes certain things in meditation practice more difficult for us. So, most of us have visited or have been visited by the second meditation hindrance. It's necessary that you recognize its shades. You know? It's not always really a full-blooded, murderous hatred. Yeah, sometimes it's a subtle, seething aversion, or, you know, just kind of a niggling criticism. You know. If she just stopped doing what she was doing. One way of recognizing it, it can sound very reasonable, you know, very justified, very righteous, you know, very slightly indignant, but yet we are totally right, you know. It's an objective fact that she ... yeah. So one way of recognizing this obstacle is listening to the voice of the mind. Sometimes the mind really whinges, yeah, it's kind of high-pitched whining sound, you know? Yeah? And sometimes it's kind of really deep subterranean grumble. So you get a feel for the quality of vyapada in your mind, not just by listening or actually reading the thoughts, but by actually listening to the tone of the mind. Yeah? I have a few of those that accompany me for years, and if I start believing them, and some of them are they can sound pretty reasonable. Yeah, some of my greatest illusions, they can sound really convincing. Yeah? They have all their lines of arguments. You know, they have rehearsed their piece as well. Yeah, so this type of thing can go on in our mind, and it can go on for a long time. If you're not careful, you know, you can, anything in the mind, anything you conceive, anything you can think about, can take the color of aversion, or can take the color of rejection, or can just by kind of criticism, bitter criticism, and it can go on a long time before we notice what's happening. So it's necessary that you clearly know how your mind sounds when it is complaining, when it is moping, when it is sulking, when it is criticizing, when it is infected with the fire of aversion, the fire of dosa, the fire of vyapada. Mm-hmm. You need to know how this feels. You need to recognize it when it happens. Otherwise, you risk feeding it into it. Now, like all things, it feeds with ideas, it feeds with memory, it feeds through the fact that you believe, actually, it has right. Yeah? That's the worst thing. We give it validation by believing what the mind talks. In other words, we jump to the content of the mind's thought, rather than recognizing, ooh, this is an angry thought, look at what it does. Eee, look at the sort of voice it has. My God, we can't trust this. Yeah. Instead of doing that, you say, oh yeah, right, that's true. Oh God, she shouldn't have, really. Yeah. And instead of picking up on the sound of it, yeah, we jump at the message. We swallow the bait. Yeah. We take it. And once we have taken it, it goes on. Yeah. We think what we should do, what we're going to really tell her, you know, how she should be stopped. The manager should really something, you know. You get the whole story. And once you're in the story, it's very, very difficult to get a perspective on that this is anger. The thing that propels this experience is anger. Once you know that you can't trust it. You cannot trust anger. It's very painful. Being angry, believe that from somebody who has been angry enough in his life and is still occasionally enough angry, believe that from me is the quickest ticket to hell. Yeah, in my books, if you want to go quickly to hell, get angry. Yeah, you will say things you will regret. You will hurt people. They will take away their confidence from you. You will feel, if you want to feel lonely, miserable, and isolated, get angry. Get angry a lot. Do it publicly. You will get to know isolation, loneliness, shame, lack of self-respect. You get it all at once. So anger really is a big obstacle for the mind to quieten. When I was a young practitioner, I thought the really big obstacle is desire. So, you know, sometimes when you're a little bit angry, just a sort of a drop or two of vinegar in your blood, and you're just a little bit angry, desire is not a problem. You know? Everything, you know, that comes into your range of perception is kind of slightly acidic, yeah? And you get quite safe. You realize desire doesn't take hold when you're in that state. So it may feel that a little bit of anger actually helps practice, you know? You actually keep desire in check. So also you have a feeling, you know, conceptually, you have a feeling that if you're a little bit sort of aggressive in your mind, actually quite fast, quite sort of, you know, bitey, so quite clear, you know, this not. And it has taken me some time to find out that this is a great error, you know, that anger is one of the worst things you can do in terms of samadhi. An angry mind, an acidic mind, a sour mind is never, never going to become a calm and stable mind. So anger is something you need to recognize. When it turns up as a meditation experience, you need to know what its taste is like. You need to know what its sound is like. You need to know what its bodily feel is like. Yeah. The third of the obstacles the Buddha told this Brahman is the analogy of the Brahman going to seek his face and finding a vessel of water that is covered with moss. Yeah, covered with moss, so the Brahman can't see his face, but instead of the reflection he finds a layer of moss in the water. This obstacle is also something you may know. It's called, in Pali it has the sound tina midha. It means sleepiness and a sort of stiffness of mind. Yeah, it's a numbness of mind. Sleepiness, doziness. Sometimes it is translated as sloth and torpor. This is a very accurate translation. The qualities of mind when this happens is the numbness means you're still awake, but nothing somehow penetrates. Yeah? It is as if you have a very, very thick skin, or as if everything is behind plexiglass. You know, it's kind of behind a layer of protective glass. milky colored glass. So nothing kind of reaches you, like elephant skin. In meditation, you can sit, you can experience as you sit here, you're kind of upright. Sometimes the sweat drops off you and you don't get a grasp of anything. There is no breath, there is no sensation, there is no clarity, there is nothing where you could start working with. There is no orientation. It's a very strange state. It leaves you kind of insensitive and it leaves you quite helpless often because you don't have your tools. There's no awareness, there's no object of awareness, there is no domain of practice, there is no clarity and intention. It's a very sort of paralyzed state. It's not very useful staying in there. The other aspect of this is a double obstacle, is sleepiness. Sleepiness can have many shades. It can be you get up in the morning and you come here and you just want to continue sleeping. You resist somebody giving a guided meditation because you just want to continue sleeping. Please don't talk to me. Let me go back to where I came from. If you have blankets, here blankets are not so popular because it's hot, but in Europe people have blankets, so they generally take their blankets very up, get as close as they can to the memory of how it was in bed and just kind of try to huddle and wait till it's over, So this is a very straightforward way of adopting sleepiness as a meditation practice. Obviously, it has some benefits. There's a kind of a minor restoration of physical resources can be found there, but no samadhi, no insight, no liberation. You waste a lot of time like that. Another form of sleepiness is, the sort of early afternoon sleepiness, with a full stomach, and it doesn't really hurt sitting there with a full stomach and you've done it a few days and you're not going to run away, no. That's quite peaceful, really. And that's what it is about, isn't it? Buddhism is about peace. And you suddenly get really very peaceful. Your thoughts are no longer so oppressive. There's no really hard edges in your mind. There's definitely no hatred there. No big desires either. It's really quite peaceful. And because you have very little thought, it actually feels really like samadhi. This must be peaceful. And then your perceptions start to go, and you feel, wow, that wasn't difficult. I thought it would take me longer to get there. And very soon you're reaching the state of neither perception nor non-perception. This is really clearly an arupa jhana you're having. And the next stage is you bump your nose somewhere. So this is a type of sleepiness that has to do with digestive processes or with the heat in the room or with lack of oxygen or with lack of clarity in your intention, lack of a quality called virya, energy, the energy of body, the energy of mind. In many ways, these are quite honest forms of sleepiness. There's obviously the sleepiness of fatigue when you have practiced long. Or when you sit up late at night, you may feel that part of your system are exhausted. Sometimes the body is exhausted, and the mind, if it is still reasonably fresh, a mind that is reasonably fresh can keep a body that is exhausted. I have had some very fine meditations after climbing mountains on that day. It's possible to be physically very exhausted and the mind, when it isn't tired, can cope with that. It can instill the body with energy. The other way around is not possible by my experience. So if your mind is tired, then your body is not able to help you with meditation. however fresh the body may be, if the mind is really exhausted, generally you drop off, you fall off your baton, as they say. Yeah, it's the kind of this experience. Yeah. There's another type of sleepiness which is more tricky, which hasn't to do with really exhaustion or honest fatigue. It has to do with not wanting to be where you are. So sometimes sleepiness sets in as a subtle type of aversion to your experience. It is a denial pattern. Yeah? Particularly people with a lot of willpower, they with the help of their willpower and their intention, they put themselves through strong experiences. Yeah? Like coming into a Buddhist meditation retreat. And suddenly they find that the mind resists. Yeah? While part of their mind wants this, another part doesn't want it all. And if the willpower is used just to run over that part which does resist, sometimes the mind reacts by going to sleep. You know, it's kind of like a sulky child. He says, okay, you can take me there, but I'm not going to eat. You know? You can push me into school, but I'm not going to learn anything at all. And so the meditator's mind says, okay, fine, you can get me there in the morning at 6 o'clock, but you can even get me to sit there and be still, but I won't meditate. You know? I will not pay attention. I will not be aware. I will just sleep. I will roll in and sleep. So this part of us which refuses to follow that willful impulse. And sometimes the mind blocks, you know, by shutting down. He can force me to sit there, but he can't force me to be awake. So you come in, absolutely fresh, everything is fine, you sit down, somebody says something about meditation, and suddenly you fall off. Yeah. After a while he rings the bell, ding ding ding, you start feeling fresh again, the sky is blue, everything is fine. Just somebody says, meditate, and you just kind of get incredibly fatigued, you know. Something goes heavy and everything starts to droop and fall and melt. If you have not been there, be thankful. If those of you who have been there will know, it can be quite powerful. If you're a long-term meditator, you will encounter that type of resistance. If you're new, generally you have too much pain and too much excitement and too much kind of spinning thoughts to keep you awake. But once you get a little more peaceful, sleepiness becomes a lot more of a danger in meditation practice. So the obstacle of the mossy water, the obstacle of numbness, this is one part, that's the second part of the Pali word, and the obstacle of sleepiness or of sloth are powerful obstacles. Yeah. Every contemplative tradition struggles with that. Even great meditators have struggled with that. Some of you may be familiar with Moggallana. Yeah, Pramoggallana, one of the great disciples of the Buddha, one of the early disciples and a man of great psychic power and meditational achievements. Even he struggled with sleepiness, and the Buddha very fatherly gave him advice on how to cope with sleepiness. One of these advices was to massage his earlobes. I think this is one of the first documented cases of ear reflexology, which can be found in Pali Buddhism. So sleepiness is a big challenge if you are a long-term practitioner, and if your mind meets resistance. You know, some of the things don't want to be looked at in our hearts, in our psyches. So one way of protecting themselves from our investigation is by shutting down the mind. Whenever it starts getting a bit tricky or a bit in the near vicinity of my trouble area, suddenly the meditator becomes incredibly tired, incredibly heavy, incredibly, you know, the view kind of clouds over. Yeah, we're in a fog world. Yeah, Now, if you encounter such things, ask yourself, have you slept enough? How did you feel just before you came to meditate? Was it okay? Find out, how is it afterwards? Yeah. Is it happening when you are at a particular topic or in a particular region of your body? Sometimes people go into a particular region of their body and their bodies don't want them to go there. So because they're diligent and willful meditators, they go there anyway, yeah? And they just kind of get stuck, as if they're running into a forest, yeah, a thicket of something. So this is an obstacle you may have to expect. The next, number four, is also a double obstacle. The Pali words for it are udaccha, which means restlessness, agitation of a physical sort, and kukucha, which means it's a kind of anxiety. It has to do with conscience. It's a mental agitation combined with anxiety, and has to do, it's kind of, you think about things you shouldn't have done. You have compunctions, as they say, yeah? It's your conscience that nibbles at your peace and says, oh, this shouldn't have gone, okay, you shouldn't have done that, this is not good, yeah? So, the analogy the Buddha gave to the Brahman was an analogy that the water that our Brahman finds is moved by wind. It is whipped up. It is not calm. It is not a flat surface. So again, he looks to find his face, to recognize his true face, his true nature, and he cannot, because the surface of the water is moved by wind. It is agitated. Now, how would that feel if you sit here and you have these restlessness and agitation hindrances? The restlessness hindrances is very easy. You would physically be uncomfortable. You would itch. You would fidget around. You know, you would sit here and then suddenly you would feel a terrible pull somewhere in your buttock, and you know there is a fault there. And if you don't move that fault, your sciatica nerve will be pinched. And if your sciatica nerve will be pinched, your leg will go to sleep, and you'll probably lose that leg. And I'm not sure whether it's worth losing a leg for that little bit of samadhi. So you need to move. So you move that fold. And then you sit still, and then suddenly you feel this kind of pathway of ants going up your neck. And you know, you've never had that, so it must be something horrible that's creeping. There must be some scorpions around still, you know. They sometimes creep up on meditators' heads. So you kind of do your thing. So that was out of the way. And then you sit here, and then suddenly you have this hiccup, you know. You sit here, you have this hiccup. Or another favorite meditator's illness is this kind of compulsive swallowing. You know? You do these loud, gulping, swallowing noises, you know, that you can hear through 100 people. And there you sit, you know, you come to this meditation retreat that cost you so much, and you save so much time, and you organize so many things to get the kids really in good care, and there you are swallowing so that the whole hall can hear. Everybody is meditating and probably attaining jhanas by now, and you were there swallowing. So this is a kind of restlessness. And the experience is that, you know, once we deprive ourselves of the ability to move freely, to do things, to talk, and we came to sit still, what happens is that sometimes the mind produces body symptoms, you know. It is as if the mind entertains itself with bodily symptoms, with itches and twitches, with, you know, ants running across your legs, and once you start giving in to some of them, they'll never stop. Yeah. They just change. What you do is you just shift location. You get rid of that itch, and suddenly another itch, which you have never had in your life before, crops up, and you obsess with it, and it gets so intense that you need to do something about it. So you spend your time obsessing and negotiating your obsessions with physical symptoms. And you know, as an entertainment program, it works. You know? It stops you from gaining stillness. It stops you from gaining calm. So this is one of the a very well-documented phenomenon, and it obviously makes your neighbors mad if you kind of fidget around and your 15th postural change, you know, where you have to rebuild your cushions and so forth. It generally agitates not just your own meditation experience, it agitates a few others. You could also, this can go into your breath, you know, you can go sort of into a coughing fit, or what is even more successful is the chest about suppressed coughing fits, you know. You can kind of spend 15 minutes just, you know, on the verge of exploding, you know, just trying to fight back an impulse to clear your throat and really give a big loud cough. And you can just, you know, the sweat can pour off your forehead just to hold that down. So obviously it's ruinous for your meditation experience. It makes you unhappy, it makes you kind of contracting, and the mind never gets still like that. So the very cheap but well honed advice is spend 2-3 minutes initially with your posture, and then sit still, yeah? And if you can, don't move, don't scratch, don't do it, yeah? If you start, it is possible that it will continue and not stop. If you don't move and you don't scratch and you don't, you know, crack your bones, after a while the body will give up. It's like a cat. It's curious, it comes, it waits, it begs. And if it doesn't get something, it'll come and check for another couple of days, yeah? Just to be sure, but it will come less often, you know, and if it really doesn't get anything, it will go away. If you start feeding it, you'll be sure it's going to be around, you know. What did you expect? So restlessness is unpleasant, but it's reasonably straightforward. It's reasonably obvious when it happens. You can reasonably recognize it. The next one, sort of compunction and agitation of the mind due to conscience, is more tricky. This may have some real foundation. You may really become conscious of having been irresponsible in something, of having let down somebody. You may really feel genuinely guilty for something that wasn't good in your life. But as a meditation obstacle, you know, it's not a normal, healthy shame of having lived beneath your moral standards. There is something, again, compulsive in it, you know. There's an aspect of self-flagellation in it, yeah? There's something self-punishing in it. Something that doesn't want to let you peace. Something that wants to hurt you and punish you. And now it's punishing you by not letting you get still, by not letting you get samadhi. Okay? He hasn't been perfect. Fair enough. Well, we'll take away his sweet, yeah? He gets punished, so he wasn't perfect in his life, so at least we don't let him get samadhi. There he has it. That is his penalty. So sometimes it is only in meditation that we become aware of having done something that is not correct, or that is unskillful, or that is heartless, yeah? One of the things that happen in meditation practice is things catch up with us. In terms of karmic activity, we're pretty harmless on a meditation retreat. Yeah. The sort of things we do are pretty harmless. You know, okay, maybe you can snatch a bit more salad or so from your neighbor. There isn't really that much horrible things you can do in a meditation retreat. The moral standards are quite high. So in such an occasion, things from the past catch up with us. You know, our mind brings up things that were not perfect in our lives, and we have maybe not been perfect in those situations. So we experience guilt and shame and remorse. Some of that is genuine. If it is a meditation obstacle, it is something insidious. It has something in it that doesn't want to let you in peace. It haunts you. Yeah, there's a tormenting element in it. You know, it's kind of a, you go back over a particular situation or a particular scenario, and you feel the kind of, oh, the twitch somewhere in your softer parts here, yeah. And you do that many times, and it's kind of, you go back over a pain or over a neglect or something you have, an omission, something you really should have done and you haven't. You weren't available, you weren't there for somebody, and it really feels bad. And maybe this has happened, but the unhealthy thing in this obstacle is the repetition of it. Yeah? There's a sort of a slightly obsessive quality to it. Imagine as if you have a, you've lost the filling in your tooth. And there's some disbelief in your body that this is gone. Yeah. So your tongue keeps going back to that place where the filling used to be and where there is now a shardy sort of hole in the tooth. And your tongue keeps kind of going back feeling how awkward this is. And the tongue is already sore, but it still keeps going back trying to really get to know this area. There's something compulsive, something strange, yeah, in our mouth where we are so familiar, our tongue is so familiar with the shapes in there. And suddenly something is strange there, and we can't really help it, although it hurts us going back there, we can't help going back there with the tongue. There's that kind of feel to this obstacle. It has its relationship to the last one, the last obstacle in the imagery of the Buddha for the Brahman Sangharava is a water that is troubled and muddy. Yeah, the Brahman seeks his reflection, and the water he tries to seek his reflection in is troubled and muddy. Yeah. The obstacle is called vichikicca, it means doubt, or it's a type of doubt that is ethical. And again, it is a type of doubt that relates to fundamental matters. Yeah? A doubt is a funny condition. Most of us think of doubt as some intellectual ambiguity or so. By my understanding, a doubt is an emotional experience that we most of the time try to cope with intellectually. If I let my doubts run wild, then I try to create probability scenarios, you know, how likely it is that that which is object of my doubt is going to happen. How likely is it that it's not going to happen? So, one way of coping with doubt, which is in my felt experience somewhere in my belly, it's happening up here, you know, very clear, not heart, lower, you know, solar plexus. It is an experience that is deeply unpleasant, and it's an experience of which I feel it shouldn't be there. And one way of coping with it is I try to figure out how probable something is, how likely something is. I try to see whether I can settle for one possible attitude, or the other, or the first, or a compromise of them, yeah? So, doubt is something I don't know, and at the same time feel I should know, yeah? I can't live with not knowing it. There's many things I don't know I can happily live with. Yeah? Don't know what we're going to eat for breakfast tomorrow morning, but I can live with that, actually. I have some good guesses, but I... yeah. But I can live with that. So, you see, not knowing things doesn't necessarily mean doubt, yeah? So there are many things we have question marks, which are perfectly okay. We're perfectly okay with this. But some things we are not okay, yeah? Some things we feel we should know. And if we do not know them, we have great trouble. Commitment. Fidelity. Efficiency. Does this work? You know, I'm going to invest several days of my holidays here. I'm going to sweat here. I'm going to listen to this guy. And does it work? You know, does he give any guarantees? Maybe he sells samadhi pills rather than this sweating exercises. Just give me the pill and let me go. Yeah? So doubt is a very, very unpleasant condition. It's the opposite of faith, confidence and trust. So if we have doubt, we never really can get going. We can never really commit. If we have doubt, generally it's doubt in ourselves, or it's doubt in a technique, a method, a religion, a government, a vehicle, something. Yeah? So there's different types of doubt. But the most devastating one is the self-doubt. It's not having the trust that something I wish to do, I'm also truly capable of doing. Yeah? Being unsure whether that which is important to me is something I am capable of doing, attaining, undertaking, and so forth. So this is devastating. What it does, it makes us vacillate. It breaks up our intention. It crumbles our bit of samadhi. It makes us ambivalent. Yeah. We cannot do one thing and happily renounce other things. We keep being afraid that we miss everything, you know. This is not going to go where we wanted to go, and yet that I had to give up to do this. So I might lose both, you know. And you will lose both in that, because you will not get the benefit of this, because you can't really do this with whole heart, with confidence. So doubt, if you know doubt is an experience, it's a disaster, really. It stops you anywhere. It undermines your success. You know, in relationship, in work, in anything you undertake. If you're a doubter, it's difficult to really commit, to really get going, to really put your energy behind a thing. Same in meditation practice. So doubt is really an unfortunate condition, and as a meditation obstacles, one speaks of addiction. You know, some people translate vichikicca with the addiction to doubt. So there's something in you, you know, that doesn't believe that things are what they look like, or that things are what they pretend to be. A very famous gentleman who has coined an aphorism of this condition was Voltaire. He said, doubt is an unpleasant condition, but certainty is ridiculous. So, if your mind has that kind of attitude, one gives you a couple of certainties, and you just can't believe it, because it can't be that simple. You know? It can't be what it looks like. This is a tendency of mind. You know, there's something in us, if we are doubters, that go in and niggle and drill, you know, and poke with the finger. We look for something that's not working. So this attitude is very unfortunate for meditation practice. It takes much energy to handle, and we go in this way a few steps, and then we go in that way a few steps, and then we are not sure whether in the center, whether we should do effort or whether we shouldn't do effort, because all effort is person-centered and personality is a problem. So if I do effort, I strengthen my personality, but actually my personality is my problem, so I better do something against it, but then for that I need effort, and then that strengthens my other personality, and so this kind of thing. So these five obstacles are very likely to show their heads somewhere in your practice. Yeah, if they don't show their heads in their practice, you're probably sure that they have you in their hand. Yeah. If you haven't met them, they have met you, be sure. Yeah? So be wary. How does it feel for you if this mind of yours has desire? You better know that. How does desire look like? Now this is not, if you're a meditator, generally desire isn't a sexual rampage. Yeah. Generally, if you sit here, where does your desire go? Yeah. Your desire goes in your head. It goes into fantasy, it goes into memory, it goes into playing around with thought. Because that's all you have here. Yeah. Maybe at the mealtime you get a little bit of a pig out. Yeah, but generally, a meditator's experience of kamajanda, of sense desire in meditation, is focused on objects of thought. So desire will turn up as the longing memory of something, or the indulgent fantasy of something, or the playful going through the ramification of something you like, you know, where you would arrange your new IKEA furniture, or how what you're going to put in the sushi when you get home, or you know, where you will drive over the weekend, or your new angling rod, or God knows what. And so anything you think of longingly, you know, the gleeful thought how we will install the latest software version on your brand new computer, or whatever tickles your fancy, this is object of desire. Thinking about this, fantasizing about it, is probably the way you experience sense desire in meditation. The same for anger. Most likely, the objects of your anger will be not that you have hateful tirades with people out here, but you will likely have the tirades in your head. You know? You will think what you tell him, what you write her, what you're really going to do about this. And you go through this in your head. And then you imagine what they say, and then you imagine what you're going to tell them after that. Or you're going to memorize, you're going to remember things that she has said long time ago that also have made you angry, you know, that only prove that this is again the same thing. Yeah. And she's done that 30 years ago already, you know, and this really needs to stop now. Or you're going to think of other people who have done similar things, you know, to you as she has, and so forth. So you use your memory to feed the emotion, and the emotion continues. With restlessness and numbness and sleepiness, I think it's obvious what's happening. Doubt, again, is thought. So three of those five obstacles to meditation will come in form of thought, of change of thought, of images, of memories, of fantasies. So consider when you negotiate thought as an obstacle in your meditation, you know, sometimes it's worth looking at what actually is this thought like. You know, is this an angry thought, or is this a greedy thought? Is this a depressed thought, or is this a gleeful thought, or so? Yeah. But if you have recurring thought patterns, at some point you will need to look at those. Yeah, there is a theme therein. Some of our thinking is just random. You know, the stuff which the mind has picked up. There an advertisement, here a little traffic message, there a radio, a piece of radio, a little conversation. And your mind just kind of plays with this, and you know, it's like putting all the stuff, the week's vegetables, putting it in one soup. Yeah. So you get, at the end of the week, you get soup with all the vegetables from the whole week in it. Sometimes our mind's chatter is like that. And all it takes is a really decisive intention to cut through this, that may help. But some of the thought, you know, there is more power in it. You know, there are themes, maybe not 100, maybe 3, yeah, maybe just one that obsesses you. So there may be a moment in your meditation when you need to look at that. At least note, all my thoughts deal with so-and-so and our work situation, or all my thoughts deal with my teenage girl, or with my partner, or yeah, or with my own lack of competence or something. You begin to recognize a particular theme of thought that is recurrent, and you make a note. Well, one day we have to look at this really closely. So consider, unfortunately, I cannot give you a clear recipe for these five hindrances. I would love to just pull out a white rabbit of my hat and say, this is the white rabbit for sense desire, this is the white rabbit for hatred, and so forth. It's not like that. Yeah. Obviously, there are tricks you can do. Yeah. sleepiness, you can sit up straight, you can breathe more deeply, you can indeed massage your earlobes, you can stand up, you can open your eyes, you can visualize the color white, and so forth. There's many practical tricks you can do, and some of them help. But if the reason for your sleepiness is more profound than just a local patch of fatigue, then all these tricks won't really help. You will need to understand what's behind that fatigue. Sometimes we're fatigued because we stress ourselves. You know, much of our effort is not very efficient or economical. We get all uptight for things that don't need really that much energy, and then we get tired once that uptightness subsides. So this cannot be fixed by a trick. It can only be fixed by your insight, by your willingness to understand what's happening there, by your patience, your insight into the dynamic of this particular obstacle. Sense desire, you need to know what you lose by following sense desire. If you sit here fantasizing your next holidays together, you will lose the possibility for samadhi. That's clear. If you've come here to gain more stillness of mind and you spend your time here fantasizing about your holidays, then you're wasting your time. You could fantasize much more comfortably at home in your hammock about it. So it needs both an awareness of what you lose by giving in to an obstacle, and what its consequences, that any fantasy about your holidays is not going to make you happy. Hatred is the same. You need to you see, the price for hatred is very high. And the habit of hating what we don't like runs very deep. So we need to be aware of the pain factor, the dukkha factor, the degree of unsatisfactoriness that is the direct result of our habits of desiring things and spending our time with that desire, or hating things and spending our time investing in hatred. Sleepiness I've touched on. Restlessness I think is fairly obvious. That again, determination helps. Clarity of what actually takes place, you know, how the mind who is helpless, that is helpless, entertains itself. Doubt, that also is a habit that runs deeper than could be fixed by simple tricks. Again, you need to understand what the prices you pay for a doubting habit, what you lose, what you stop yourself from doing, the sabotage that occurs in a systematic or into a strategic doubting attitude. So we can leave it at that tonight. I can only encourage you to try to recognize for yourself how these five things feel. Try to ask yourself, how does the body feel? How would I recognize in the body that there is desire? How would I recognize in the body that there is aversion or hatred or anger? How would I recognize in the body that there is restlessness? How would I recognize in the body that there is agitation? How would I recognize that there is numbness in the body? What is the physical symptom of numbness, of torpor? What is the symptom of doubt? How does it feel in this particular system if I am in doubt? What sensations do I have? What states do I have? Ask yourself very honestly. See, the honest question is not whether you have these things. The honest question is where you have them. Because unless you're very free, these five obstacles of meditation are the things that stop our meditation from progressing. If your meditation isn't fine, I mean really fine, then some of that, what stops it from going there, is these obstacles. So you need to know them by their names. You need to know them by their sensations. Otherwise you believe them. You believe the desire, the fantasy, you believe the anger, you believe the reasoning, you believe the doubt, He believed the restlessness and he believed the sleepiness. Yeah. So I leave you with this and leave this to your consideration. Yeah. Let's do a quick break, stretch our legs, go a few steps, and then continue sitting with Simi, is that correct? Good. Let yourself surprise. Yeah? Thank you for your attention.